I got another unsolved crime in today's episode. We're heading over to Burke County to talk about the mysterious murder of Rhonda Henson. Welcome to the NC Everything Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Curtis, and this is the bi-weekly show where I talk about everything that has anything to do with North Carolina. Now, before we begin, I want to address something. As most of you know, I'm not a former radio DJ or media producer. I'm just a regular guy, and I'm winging it. Also, I'm a one-man band. I don't have a staff or anything or anybody to kind of help me figure things out. Now, the reason I'm telling you this is because over the past year, I've had a lot of people join the Facebook group. I made a point to welcome each and every new member, but somewhere along the way, I stopped getting notifications about new members. This made it a really nice surprise when I found out how many people had joined up without my knowledge, but I do feel bad that you didn't get that small token of appreciation. So I want to say right now that I know you're there, and I really do appreciate all the support and the extra company. You're not unrecognized, and so again, thank you so much for joining. Speaking of joining, if you're new to the show and you want more NC Everything, feel free to get on Facebook, search the NC Everything Podcast, and join the group. Or you can just check out the links in the description below, if I remembered to put them in there. Also in the description, you'll find a link to Tasting NC, a monthly show I do with my wife, Jamie, where we taste everything that has anything to do with North Carolina. And if you're listening and you want to see if I look as awful as I sound, there's a link to the YouTube channel. And lastly, if you want to reach out and say hello or suggest some content for an episode, you can reach me at thencEverythingPodcast@gmail.com. And that brings us to the content. Today's episode is a listener suggestion that came in from Wanda Norton 9617. Thank you, Wanda Norton, for the suggestion. I talked about, you know, winging it on this show. For this episode, I did write a script. I'm going to go by that pretty closely. It may not be perfect, but I wanted to make sure I got everything right. And a script does kind of speed up the process. I just didn't want to sound like I'm reading the script, so I'm sorry if I do. But you'll notice that I'm looking down more than looking at the camera. And for that, I apologize. I think it's a fair trade-off. So let's get into it. Like a lot of my content, I've never heard of Rhonda Henson until it was suggested. All the murders bother me, but this one especially bothers me because there really seems to be no real motive for the crime. Of course, I guess, what is a real motive? There's no real reason to murder anybody, no justifiable reason. So you'll see there's some possible motive, but it's weak motive. It's a stupid reason to end somebody's life. But I won't jump ahead, so let's go back to 1981. Rhonda Henson was a South Carolina native who was born in a place called Great Falls. It looks like Great Falls was about 50 miles south of Charlotte. Well, it wasn't too long before Rhonda and her family pull up stakes and they move about 80 miles north and into Burke County to a town some of you may know called Valdez. It seems like Rhonda had a great family and grew up pretty happy. She must have been pretty outgoing because she ended up playing basketball and tennis and even ran track. Her mama described her as funny and happy and said she loved everyone. She went on to say that everyone loved Rhonda too and that she had plenty of friends due to her caring personality. She even had a steady boyfriend starting in her junior year of high school. His name was Greg McDowell. Rhonda's mama said that Greg was everything a lady could want during the first year of the relationship, but after that, things seemed to take a bad turn. The story is that Greg started to get pretty jealous and insecure. This, in turn, made Greg a little overbearing. Now, I mentioned that Rhonda was said to have a lot of friends. One friend in particular was named Jill Turner. Rhonda and Jill had met in the fourth grade, and they were more like sisters than friends from that point forward. Rhonda and Jill would graduate from East Burke High School together in June of 1981, but this is where they started going their separate ways, but not on bad terms. Jill was prepped and ready to head off to college. Rhonda, on the other hand, was not interested in college. She wanted to go ahead and enter the workforce, and that's what she did. At the youthful age of 19, she began working at the Hickory Steel Company as a key punch operator. And the Hickory Steel Company was in Hickory. I'm not sure the distance between Hickory and Valdez, but I don't think it's that far. And another thing, I'm not real sure what a key punch operator is. I Googled it, And one item referred to entering data into a computer using a keyboard, and another item referred to punching holes in time cards. So I'm not exactly sure what her role was there. But no matter what she was doing, she seemed like she really liked the job and she really liked making money for herself. It wasn't too long after she got started that she bought a new car, a 1981 Datsun 210. Everything seemed to be going really good for Rhonda. Well, about 3 months into her job, she was invited to the company Christmas party, her very first company party of any kind. However, as outgoing as Rhonda was, she didn't really want to go to the event. It didn't really say why. But her best friend at work, Sherry Yoder, told her that if Rhonda didn't go, she wasn't going to go. Now, I'm kind of introverted, so if you tell me that if I don't go, you're not going, okay, well, we're not going. We'll find something else to do. But Rhonda was different. This ultimatum of her best friend missing the Christmas party was enough to convince her to go. And so now we're at December 22nd, 1981, Rhonda Henson's last day on Earth. Rhonda gets up and gets ready to go to work, but the roads had gotten pretty icy overnight. She didn't feel safe driving, so she calls her friend from work, a guy named Wayne Chapman. And you don't have to remember all these names. You'll know the ones you need to remember. So her friend from work, Wayne Chapman, comes to get her, and they both drive together to the Hickory Steel Company. Later that day, kind of the last minute, Rhonda calls her mama from work and tells her to go into town and buy her something nice to wear for the Christmas party, since she had changed her mind and she decided to go after all. Well, Rhonda's mama decides to drive Rhonda's car, but after an attempt, you know, she tried to drive it, but she changed her mind because if you ever drive someone else's car, it just feels weird, you know. And so she wasn't used to driving Rhonda's car, so she eventually went back to the house and she got her own car. And I do want you to remember that fact. Rhonda's mama, she got in Rhonda's car and drove it for a little bit, so she got a really good look at what the inside of that car looks like. But Mama goes to town. She gets her a nice little outfit to wear for the Christmas party. So now Rhonda's excited. Sherry's excited. I think even Mama was excited for Rhonda. But you know who wasn't too excited? The overbearing boyfriend, Greg McDowell. Apparently, he wanted Rhonda to come spend some time with him, or at least not go spend time with anybody else. At some point, he made it known that he wanted to go as her date. But Rhonda had already decided that she and Sherry Yoder, would go together. In fact, the plan was that she would drive to Sherry's house, and they would go to the party in Hickory together from there. She told her mama that she would probably be spending the night at Sherry's house because she didn't want to drive home real late at night. So that was the plan. After getting ready to go and heading for the door, Rhonda's mama told her that she needed to take a jacket since it was pretty chilly out. Rhonda, at one point, had an East Burke High School letter jacket that belonged to boyfriend Greg. She told her mama that the jacket in question was at Greg's house. She didn't have the jacket with her at the time. No worries. She also had a gray hoodie. No, that wasn't true. The gray hoodie, she told her mama, was in another friend's car, Mark Turner. You remember her best friend from high school, Jill Turner. Well, Mark was Jill's boyfriend. And she told her mama that the gray hoodie was in Mark's car. She had accidentally left it in his Buick after a shopping trip. So anyway, she would go to the party without the jacket. She says bye to her mama and she drives over to Sherry's house in Hickory. She left her car there as planned and the pair went to the party in Sherry's car. I'm assuming she had a pretty good time because she was there until somewhere around midnight. According to the Burke County Sheriff's Department, Rhonda left the party around midnight with a couple of friends. And I had one source that said she left with a couple of friends. All my other sources said it was just her and Sherry, or they left out the mention of a couple of friends. Likewise, a lot of my sources said it was just her and Sherry who went to the party, but one source said that there was another friend at Sherry's house that rode with them. But I don't think it's necessarily important about this friend's existence. Now, at some point, Rhonda decides to call boyfriend Greg. I couldn't really figure out if she called him before she left the party or after she got to Sherry's house, but she did call her boyfriend at some point. I'm not real sure what was said on this brief phone call, but Rhonda was quoted as saying that Greg was pretty mad. She told Sherry that she thought this was it. She and Greg were finally going to break up. Now, despite when she made the phone call to boyfriend Greg, ultimately she gets to Sherry's house okay. But then she decides to head home. Now, you could probably debate whether or not she talked to her boyfriend or not, but keep in mind, she's heading home. The original plan was for her to spend the night at Sherry's house. So something changed her mind about that. So now it's somewhere after midnight and she's on her way back to Valdez. Anyway, she gets on Interstate 40 and heads west. After a little bit, she gets on the exit ramp and gets off on Eldred Street. That's E-L-D-R-E-D, Eldred Street. She turns right and starts heading up the hill, now less than a mile from home. And that's it. That's all the authorities can really say for certain about what Rhonda Henson's actions were on the night of December 22nd. Well, I guess, actually, this is after midnight, so now we're early morning hours, December 23rd. But either way, Rhonda Henson's life ended on that hill. But I want to back up a few minutes before Rhonda took that exit ramp to go home. A witness who later came out said she drove under the overpass sometime between 12:15 and 12:30, and she recalled seeing something kind of odd. She describes a blue Chevrolet that was parked next to the off-ramp that Rhonda would be using moments later. She recalled seeing two white males inside the car. About 30 minutes later, the sound of a gunshot would ring out in the cold night air. Nobody saw the shooter, but nearby neighbors heard the shot. After the shot, Rhonda's beige Datsun rolled backwards down the hill on Eldridge Street. It crossed the road and slammed into a ditch on the southbound side. She was 300 feet away from the exit ramp. Sometime before 1 a.m., a man named Reggie Smart was on his way home from a garage where he worked. As he came up on the interstate overpass, he saw the beige car sitting in the ditch. The driver's side door was open and the interior light was on. Well, Reggie slows down as he drove by and he saw a blonde woman slumped over the steering wheel, but he didn't stop. Why? Well, she wasn't alone. Standing outside the open driver's side door, Reggie saw a man who he would later describe as a white 6 foot tall guy, around 170 pounds. He was just standing there outside the open door. Well, Reggie assumed it was late night partygoers who had too much to drink and they decided to pull over, so he continued on his way. Reggie would be the only eyewitness to see Rhonda's body still inside the car. A little after 1 a.m., another couple happened to be coming down Eldred Street. This would be Tim Pons and Mark Michael. They were riding in Mark's blue Trans Am. After seeing the beige Datsun in the ditch, they pulled over into a nearby driveway and they walked over to see what was going on. The car was still running, the headlights were still on, and they could hear the low music from the radio. They walked up on the passenger side of the vehicle, and immediately they saw not the body of a young woman. They saw a bullet hole and a lot of blood in the front seat. Now, keep in mind the way this car was angled, it was kind of pointed up the hill, and the end of the car, the butt end of the car, was in the ditch. And the driver's side door up here was open. I don't know if that, if you're watching on YouTube, I don't know if my hand signals help. But they had walked up on the passenger side. Well, Tim Pons, he starts walking around to the driver's side and to see, you know, what was on the other side of the car. But Mark Michael, he stopped him and said they need to go get the police. So these two start heading for their own car when a couple of their friends happened by. These newcomers were Jerry Baker and Todd Garou. They pull into a garden center that's located nearby, and they yell to Tim and Mark, "Hey, what happened?" Tim and Mark say they don't know, but they need the police. And with this, Jerry and Todd crank up and drive towards town. Well, they were looking for anybody in law enforcement who could help. Now, it's the middle of the night. There's not a whole lot of people around. It said they were running red lights, just trying to draw some attention from somebody who could help. Finally, they run into Lieutenant Harry Feimster and convince him to follow them back to where their friends are waiting. Sources say that about 10 minutes had passed from the time they saw Tim and Mark till the time the lieutenant got back there with them. And just for an accurate timestamp now, they said Rhonda left the party somewhere around midnight. Well, at 1:14 a.m., the lieutenant starts running the plates of Rhonda's beige Datsun. So you take away the time Rhonda left the party with Sherry to go back to her house, and not much time has passed since Rhonda was last seen alive at this point. Now, back at the scene, like I said earlier, Tim and Mark, they didn't see anybody around the vehicle despite an earlier witness, Reggie, seeing two individuals. The reason Tim and Mark didn't see anyone was because the male that they had seen was now gone. Rhonda, however, was still there, but she was out of sight for Mark and Reggie. Remember, I talked about the car going into the ditch at kind of an angle with the nose pointing north and the tail end of the car in the ditch. Well, the driver's side door was still open. Rhonda was now laying on the ground behind the open driver's side door towards the back of the car. Her head had been propped up onto the rear tire and her arms were placed by her sides. So if those guys did walk around the car, they probably, and looked around the open door, they probably would have seen Rhonda laying there. So in order to get to the body, the lieutenant used his elbow to shut the driver's side door, and when he did, he noticed two things. One, that the driver's side window was rolled halfway down despite the chilly night air. Two, the interior light remained on. And in case you're not putting two and two together, when he shut the door, the interior light stayed on. This indicates that the light was on not because the door was open, but because somebody had manually cut the interior light on. After determining that Rhonda was indeed deceased, the lieutenant began looking around the vehicle. And the car was a complete mess, with items strewn all over the back seat. Remember when Rhonda told her mama that her jacket was at boyfriend Greg's house and her hoodie was in that friend Mark Turner's car? Well, both of these items were found together in the back seat of Rhonda's car. Another item that was in the car was a pink stuffed snake. Now, remember this pink snake. I'll get back to it later. The lieutenant also notices a bullet hole. It was in the trunk, a little less than a foot off-center towards the driver's side. It would be discovered that the bullet from a high-powered rifle, not a pistol, was fired into the trunk. The bullet then traveled through the car, through the seat, and into Rhonda's lung and heart. They believe the shot would have killed her almost instantly. Police weren't on scene too long before curious onlookers started showing up and a crowd started gathering. One thing I want to insert here is that one visitor to the crime scene stood out more than the others. His name was Charles McDowell. His son, Greg, was Rhonda's boyfriend. And maybe this is nothing, but keep in mind, it's somewhere around 2 o'clock in the morning at this point. I could see folks in the general vicinity being woken up and coming out to see what was going on, but why was Charles McDowell awake and driving around in the middle of the night? And this isn't even Christmas Eve when a lot of people are up until the wee hours of the morning. It's December 23rd. Anyway, after law enforcement realized who this newcomer was, he was told to head up to the Henson house, Rhonda's mama, and just wait. Rhonda's parents were getting the tragic news around 3 o'clock that morning. On Christmas Day, they were burying their only daughter. Meanwhile, the Burke County Sheriff's Department was just getting started on trying to figure out why this happened and who would want to end Rhonda Henson's life. One of the first people they looked at was Rhonda herself. What was going on with her? So let's kind of explore that a little bit. It seems that she was certainly acting a little strange in the weeks leading up to her murder. Like I said earlier, most sources had described Rhonda as joyful and outgoing, and that seems to have changed at some point. Her mom was quoted as saying that she just didn't seem very happy. When her dad would leave out in the early hours of the morning for his own job, he said he'd often see his daughter just standing at her bedroom window staring out. And this wasn't sunrise. This was like 2 o'clock in the morning most times when her dad would go out, essentially the middle of the night, and Rhonda was just standing there looking out the window. And then there was the odd question. Well, it seems to be a very random occurrence. One day, Rhonda asked her mother if it was okay to date a married man. Her mama tells her this is never a good idea and it only leads to people getting hurt. It seems like this was the only time that Rhonda had brought that subject up, but it was still kind of random. Then she had kind of a weird exchange with her dad. You see, Rhonda had never had any issues driving herself wherever she needed to go, but in the weeks before the murder, she suddenly didn't want to be as alone as much. She'd often ask her dad to drive her to town as opposed to going by herself. And it was on one of these trips that she told her dad something along the lines of, "I want to tell you something and you're not going to like it." Her dad told her that she could always tell him anything, and then Rhonda suddenly, you know, lost her courage. She backpedaled and told her dad that she would think about telling him later, but she never really got the chance. I did read in several sources that there was some evidence found that indicated that Rhonda may have had a stalker, but nothing specific was ever described about this. Before I move on, I want to say that nobody ever knew what Rhonda was going to tell her daddy that day, but maybe she told somebody else. I don't mean to drop a random bomb here, but Rhonda supposedly confided in one of her cousins. She told this cousin that her boyfriend's dad, the Reverend Charles, had made advances toward her. She didn't go into too much detail, apparently, but it was said that the preacher would be waiting for her when she came out of the bathroom whenever she was over at Greg's house. And I'm not going to get into speculation right here, but if she was curious about whether or not she could date a married man, I mean, maybe it was reciprocated. Maybe she was kind of into the preacher, or at least considering the possibility. But again, I'm just speculating. I have no sources to say that Rhonda ever had any attraction toward Preacher McDowell. Anyway, Rhonda's parents were asked about the messy condition of the car that they found. And you remember I said that Rhonda's mama had driven the car that morning of her death. She remembered very well that the car was certainly not trashed the way the lieutenant had described. So then they speak with Sherry Yoder, the work friend who had driven Rhonda to the Christmas party. Even though they took Sherry's car, apparently Sherry got a pretty good look at Rhonda's car that night as well, and she too said that the interior was not messed up the way the police had described. So now let's talk about the McDowells, and not just boyfriend Greg. I said that Charles McDowell came to the crime scene that morning, and he was sent to the Henson house to wait. He'd soon get a call from his wife, and he'd tell her that she needed to come up to the Henson house as well. This was only a few minutes after police had called boyfriend Greg from the Henson house to tell him that his girlfriend was dead. Supposedly, Charles was witnessed making a second phone call after he had called his wife. You see, he was a preacher. Officers overheard part of this second phone call, and they claimed that it sounded like he was making funeral arrangements at 3 o'clock in the morning, only hours after the murder. They thought this was kind of strange, and so do I. Ultimately, it would be the preacher McDowell who did the funeral for Rhonda. But I still think it's kind of weird to be making funeral arrangements that early into the incident. Eventually, boyfriend Greg shows up to the Henson house, and he was described as being distraught and nauseous. They said he vomited several times while he was at the house. Someone else was at the house that morning, a friendly neighbor named Sarah McBrayer. And she says she noticed something weird about boyfriend Greg. He was clean-shaven and seemed to have been freshly showered. I'm not fishing here for anything that points to boyfriend Greg, but again, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, after some time, the McDowells, Charles, his wife, and boyfriend Greg, they leave the Henson house and head back home. Now, I'd like to say here that I'm about to blow this case up, but I'm actually starting to wind down. I mean, Greg was interviewed a few times over the years. He said some odd things, and so did his weird-ass daddy, but nothing ever really came of anything, or at least not yet. I will say both of them have been kind of less than forthcoming, but I'll kind of get into what each of them had to say. I was talking about boyfriend Greg, you know. I want to say she started dating him in her junior year, so at the time of her murder, they had been dating about 2 years. However, when questioned about his relationship with Rhonda, when the preacher was questioned about his relationship with Rhonda, he said he barely knew her. And the thing is, they've been dating 2 years. 2 years, and he says he barely knew his son's girlfriend. My son has a girlfriend, and they've been together about 2 years, give or take. I don't know the actual timeline. And I don't know my son's girlfriend like she's my own daughter, but over the past couple of years they've been dating, I've learned quite a bit about her. But the reverend is acting like he barely knows Rhonda. And there's a phrase for that. There's a word for what that's called in therapy. I don't remember what it is, but what he's doing is distancing himself from Rhonda. He can't physically do it. So in words, he's trying to put as much space between him and the victim as possible. He claimed that when Rhonda would come over, he and his wife would retire to their bedroom and leave Greg and Rhonda alone to visit. Now ask yourself, do you really believe a Southern preacher up in the hills would leave his teenage son and girlfriend alone to visit? My own mama wouldn't even do that, and she was certainly not a woman of the cloth. Rhonda had spoke to her family several times about going out to dinner on several occasions with the McDowells, or simply just having lunch at her house, but again, the preacher tried to distance himself from Rhonda. He claimed they never once ate together. Then there's boyfriend Greg, and I can tell you that the apple don't fall too far. He was interviewed a few times over the years, and he seemed to have trouble remembering what he said last time. I'd mentioned earlier that Greg was upset about Rhonda going to the Christmas party, and at the very least, not taking him with her. Yeah, I said that right. Then there was the phone call that night where Rhonda said that Greg was mad and that they were probably breaking up. Well, in early interviews, Greg claimed that he didn't even know Rhonda had gone to the party, and he claimed that when he spoke to her on the phone, he thought she was at home. A later interview revealed that he knew she was out with her friend that night. And then there was the pink snake. Remember I mentioned the stuffed pink snake that was in the back seat of the car? In early interviews, Greg seemed to have no recollection of this snake at all. In a later interview, he finally remembered getting the snake on a trip to Myrtle Beach, and he had commented that the snake stayed on his nightstand. Again, by his own words, the snake in question stayed on his nightstand, yet it was in the car that morning, along with his letter jacket and the hoodie that was supposedly in the car of that other friend. Keep in mind, during all this, Greg never once mentioned seeing Rhonda on the night of the 22nd, and certainly not in the early hours of December 23rd. Now, personally, I don't think this is a really hard puzzle to put together. I'll quote what an investigative reporter told the Reverend McDowell in one of his last conversations that they had. The reporter gave his blunt theory. He said, quote, "During the early morning of Wednesday, December 23rd, 1981, Rhonda Henson met Greg McDowell at the I-40 exit 112, at which time he returned items belonging to his girlfriend of 2 years. An argument ensued between the couple, after which Rhonda drove away. With a high-power rifle that he had removed from his automobile, the younger McDowell shot in the direction of Rhonda's vehicle, the bullet entering the trunk of the car, subsequently killing her. Moreover, the whole family covered it up." End quote. Now, if I didn't have anything to do with this, at that point, I'd probably get angry and deny all of it, and there'd be a lot of words exchanged. I might even talk about getting a lawyer. Well, not the preacher. After the preacher heard what I just quoted to you, he simply stated, "That's just a theory." And that's all he said. That was his only reply to all of that. Unfortunately, that's really all I have on the Rhonda Henson murder. Over the years, Greg has only been interviewed a few times, and Charles McDowell has never officially been interviewed that I know of. There's currently a $20,000 reward for information that will lead to an arrest in the Rhonda Henson murder, but personally, I think it's just about solved. Unfortunately, like Tom Cruise said in A Few Good Men, it's not about what you know, it's about what you can prove. And that's a hard pill to swallow. Anyone with information about the murder of Rhonda Henson is asked to call the Burke County Sheriff's Department at 828-438-5506. Now, my final thoughts on it, I know y'all are probably ready to wrap up. I like the investigative reporter's theory. I think Greg McDowell did break up with Rhonda that night, or vice versa. And I think at some point that night, probably at the overpass, he did meet her and probably aggressively throw all his shit in her car. If you've ever been broken up with or broke up with somebody, it's emotional. I doubt he was delicately saying, "Okay, here's my letter jacket and here's the pink snake." No, he was probably just throwing that shit in there and cussing her out the whole time. One thing I don't like about the investigative reporter's theory, he says that she drove away and he went to his car, got a high-powered rifle, and fired in her direction. I feel like the only way that could be true is if he had that rifle ready to go because he intended on shooting her that night, or at least had it as a backup plan. Maybe he didn't mean to kill her, but I'm saying the rifle had to be ready. That had to be part of the plan. If it wasn't part of the plan, I would say that somebody else was there that night. If somebody else was there that night shooting at her car, not necessarily murdering her, but shooting at her car was definitely part of the plan, and they were already sitting somewhere with the sights on her, waiting to pull the trigger. I just don't think in haste he grabbed his rifle and shot at the car. So I can't say for sure I'm sold that Greg McDowell shot Rhonda Henson, but I am convinced he was involved. I think we have a case here of like the JonBenet Ramsey case. I think somebody in that family killed her, and everybody in the family decided to cover it up. But again, all of North Carolina can be convinced that the McDowells murdered that girl. It's not about what you know, it's about what you can prove. And so far, there's not been enough proof to convict anybody or charge anybody, I guess. I feel like one day with technology changing and stuff, they will solve this crime. Somebody will be charged, maybe even post-mortem. But I think Rhonda's poor family will never live to see that. I think if that happens, it'll be too far down the road. But anyway, that's the end of this episode, The Murder of Rhonda Henson. I hope you guys enjoyed it as best as you could enjoy an episode of this nature. And if you did like the show, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And check out the links below for more NC Everything. Thank you again, Wanda Norton 9617, for suggesting this episode. And if any of you have an idea for a show, you can reach me at thencEverythingPodcast@gmail.com. Thank you all for listening, and I'll talk to you in a couple weeks.